Welcome to STEM Spots, a weekly science review produced in cooperation with the Missouri State University Department of Physics, Astronomy, and Materials Science.
Hi, this is Dave Cornelison, and you're listening to the web version of STEM Spots. And with me in the studio today is Andy Bryan, who is one of the pastors at Campbell United Methodist Church here in Springfield, Missouri. Thanks for stopping by, Andy.
Thanks for the invitation, Dave. It's great to be here.
So setting this up, basically, I've been interested for a while in the future of work, artificial intelligence, robotics, things like that. I've talked to a number of people about that and about how cast into the future, not the dystopian robots take over the world future, but instead robots take away all your work and you're given lots of free time and everything becomes rainbows and sunshine.
Yeah.
And it isn't clear to me that that's necessarily the way we would even approach it or the way we're approaching it now. So one of the things I'm very interested in is human value and whether we ascribe it to inherent personhood or whether we ascribe it to things that you do. So the first thing I'd ask you is, do you believe that it's more important to ascribe value to just existence and personhood, or is it right to ascribe value to also the things that we do?
It's a complicated question because, of course, work has value. It is important to be contributing to the common good and to be building one another up. So yes, in some sense, work has value and one's contribution to society has value. And yet, there's something inherent about our value as well. Just by existing, just by being a person, we are worth something. There is value there. It's one of the places that this emerges a lot is people that I talk with who are at the end of life. And so they're wondering, I hear all the time, I wonder why I'm still here. I wonder, God must have something for me to do, right? Some purpose for me. And their assumption is that they then, if they cannot contribute to society anymore, then they must have diminished their worth somehow or other. And my work is to talk with them about how just because they exist, they are worth it. They're valuable.
So we agree that
it's a both and.
So we agree that both things matter, but in your experience, which goes back years and the kinds of things you do, and also some of the things I see currently, which way is it trending, let's say? Are people mostly putting value on themselves and others because of who they are or because of what they do when you see that?
I think, again, a complicated question. I think I see more and more in my work as a pastor that people are wrestling with these issues. And I'm not sure if that's because the issue is more prevalent or if because people are more aware of the issue. But I talk to people all the time who come to me to talk about where do they fit in? What's my purpose here? How do I find fulfillment? Fulfillment is a big thing for people. How am I fulfilled in my life? And is it because of what I do or because of who I am? So there's an aspect of the self and self-worth that I see a lot. But I also talk with a lot of people who are wrestling with their expectations of others. And what I mean by that is, so for example, a parent will come to me to talk about their grown child who is no longer functioning in the family, no longer contributing to that health of the family system, but it's their kid, and they love their kid, and they value their kid. So they are struggling with their idea of the value of another person, balancing what that person can contribute to the health of the family system versus that person's just very identity as their child.
Right.
So it is one of the most common things that I, as a pastor, deal with when I talk to people. But again, I don't know if that's because it's more prevalent in the world or if people have just become more self-aware and understand the issue differently now.
So when people talk to you, because I know there's a third thing that does happen, because I hear about it from people, when people are talking about, as we've discussed in our own private conversations, let's call it the other can be a stand-in for anything, people that you don't understand that live in the same town to people on the other side of the world who have a different faith system or whatever it is. When people come and talk to you about those circumstances, because I know sometimes people get up in arms, let's call it, about their perceptions of what's going on around them, do they talk about the people's personhood, or do they talk about actions, the way they do things, their contributions to society? I read a lot of YouTube comments, and because I like to watch YouTube videos of old music and this and that, and it's amazing how you can have into a generic YouTube video of the Beatles somebody talking about the socialists need to be locked up or whatever it is. So,
well,
I mean,
first of all, first rule, never read the comments. First rule. Okay, so I would also say this, and it's a great question. It's very difficult to recognize the personhood of someone who looks very different than yourself. It's a challenge. Whatever that difference might be, whether that difference is just how you grew up, or socioeconomic level, or sexual orientation, or nation of origin, or language of origin, whenever there's a difference between people, it becomes more difficult to see that person as a person of value. And so part of the challenge is, again, to get past those differences, which are substantive, and recognize that each individual does have worth, regardless of how different their demographics might be. Let me reiterate.
Yes.
Don't read the comments.
I like to read the comments because I like to rile myself up
a little bit. Okay.
There you go. But yes, if I produced the video, then I certainly wouldn't read the comments because that's a way to just drive yourself crazy.
I understand.
Never read the press. But, you know, in my own experiences with a lot of students, I have noticed certainly over the last, I believe, 15 years or so, that students are becoming more inclined to come to me. I was department head for many years and talk to me, and almost always, if there were negative things that they were dealing with, they weren't about their abilities to do. They were about whether or not they should be involved in doing. Mm. So they were struggling most of the time with their own questions of, is this worth doing? Should I be the person doing it? Am I worth investing in, and so forth? Not questions usually about, I'm trying very hard on this and I'm engaged fully, but I just don't understand how to do it, which is a different sort of a question.
It's very different. And I wonder if, are we better able to articulate that now? So whereas we may have at one point said, I'm really struggling at work, which is easy to say because that's something that presents.
Sure.
It's harder to say I'm struggling with who I am,
right,
and it's manifesting with a struggle at work.
I agree. Now, when you start to present this whole idea that people are already in the environment that we're in, where there's relatively quite a bit to still do, and people, when you talk about what's my role, what's my purpose, you can at least point them to working within the community, advancing the community, as well as dealing with the issues that they have inside themselves, but presented with this opportunity that conceivably, if everything goes well, according to some scientific people and technical people, there will be less and less to do. Now, on one hand, people say, oh, everybody will just train to become a computer programmer, or they'll all do art, or they'll all be very – and for my own observations of people, just because they have more free time on their hands doesn't necessarily mean that they start producing all kinds of amazing stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So what I worry about the most is that 20 years down the road, 30 years down the road, ennui, depression and other things will become more prevalent in the absence of fewer things that make us feel worthy.
I hear that. I think it's going to be a mixed bag. I think there probably would be people who feel more liberated to explore more creative impulses. But I also feel like there would be people who think, now I can watch the entirety of that Netflix show without interruption and everything in between there. So the question is still out there. It's worth talking about now, though, before the situation becomes – I mean, we're not talking about a far future issue here. We're talking about a very present and ongoing issue. And we really need to be talking about that now ahead of that change before it becomes
more
permanent.
And so where could that conversation occur? I mean, it's unlikely that it's going to occur in the school system because they're busy just trying to pass their reading proficiency exams and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And so people would say that's foisted off on parental units. It isn't clear to me that parental units always have enough time between trying to keep their head above water and so forth.
I can give you an amen on that one. Yes.
Yes. So, I mean, where could it happen?
I'm going to challenge that it cannot happen in schools. I think systematically it probably won't happen in schools, but I think individual teachers in classrooms do it every day. I think individual teachers in classrooms are working hard to affirm individual students. And I've seen teachers of our own kids who have been swamped and overwhelmed with, you know, having to fill out forms and do extra duties and all those kinds of things and get ready for tests and that kind of stuff, but who also manage to take the time to just really pour into and affirm individual students in their various struggles. One poet once said, you know, a good teacher is the one who can make a C feel like an A and make a B minus feel like an F to different students based on how they know those students and how those students, their own inherent worth and their own inherent capacities. So it can happen in schools, but I think it happens relationally. I think the key here is that wherever it happens in relationship. It happens in community. And from my perspective, from a Christian perspective, that relationship is the faith community, that a community of faith gathered together. There's an unconditional quality to our relationships. There needs to be, there should be, an unconditional quality to our relationships that says, yeah, we're together here. We use family language in the church. You are sister, you are brother. We are one body. And that unconditional connection starts with affirming the inherent worth of the individual, no matter what they do work-wise.
Now, the interesting thing about that, and this isn't criticism, and you know it isn't, but inside any faith community or community in general, there's always emphasis at some level that there's many things for us to be busy doing. And so we try to engage people and get them to do the things that we think they'll be good at. Usually we try very hard. People like you and other people try very hard. This person seems to have a giftedness in here, and let's try to get them. And the one thing we typically don't want is people that are just sitting back and just absorbing the love, let's call it that.
Okay.
And so how do you – I'm not saying they're counter to each other, because we've already agreed that both are important. But sometimes people will think, oh, you only love me because of what I can do for you.
Sure, and that makes a lot of sense, and it does – look like that. If I could get theological for just a second,
sure.
The motivation for the doing comes from the acceptance. So what we do in the church community is always response. It's always our expression of gratitude or our response to something that we have received. So theologically speaking, when one receives the grace of God, then one then responds with action. The action does not earn the grace of God. The action does not earn the acceptance. So it's a matter of order, of priority, if you will. Yes, we want to get people engaged. We want to get people active and doing things in the faith community. But all that we do in the faith community is in response to what has already happened.
Right.
Namely, we've been created, we are affirmed, our sacred worth is valued, we are offered grace, and therefore then we respond.
Now, taking a complete tangent from that, and I agree with everything you said, but taking a complete tangent from that, if you go back to something like the atomic bomb, scientists...
It's a good tangent, but it's
connected. So, because it's going to go towards policymakers, because each of us individually is trying to do relationships, and as you've already pointed out, we're trying to ascribe worth to people based on who they are in our own lives, especially those closest to us where we're more comfortable doing that.
Sure.
But something like the atomic bomb. Scientists were presented with what they thought was an unequivocal choice, Hitler or not. And so basically they worked on something. And at the tail end, after Hitler was defeated, many of them tried to capitulate and say, we should not use this. And policymakers took over the decisions about whether or not there would be implementation of these things. The scientists had very little say in what went on forward. And so right now it feels the same way. Scientists are going on their merry little way, making discovery after discovery. And then engineers and other people are building things. And does it seem like, to a person looking from the outside, like anybody is spending any time really on thinking about the ramifications of any of this?
I feel like we hear about not only discoveries but experiments and actions that are done. You know, the barn doors open and they've already happened well before we speak about them. It's the classic question. You know, we were spending so much time wondering if we could, we never stop to ask if we should.
Jurassic Park.
I mean, that's it. I, from my perspective as a non-scientist, it's a bit overwhelming.
Sure.
Because I, you know, you get these pictures in your mind, true or not, of scientists in laboratories in deep, dark university caverns doing things that then have huge implications, but we haven't spent any time kind of dwelling on what those implications might be and might look like. So in answer to your question, I think that the could we, the can we, is far ahead of the should we, or if not the should we, then at least what are the implications of this?
And I mean, the one thing I do worry about, and people say, well, Dave, you shouldn't, but I think it's already happening. We've already noticed that when the Rust Belt happened, right, one of the major outcomes of that was that people were displaced from longstanding occupations that had worth ascribed to them, whether they were on the line in GM or whatever it was. And now what happened? They lost their income, and they lost their identity, and they lost their self-worth.
Sure.
And so, yes, people could be retrained. And yes, people could all be computer programmers or artists or whatever it's supposed to be. But it isn't going to just happen just because we think it should happen. And so we're too much of the time, it seems to me, we're willing to say, well, we'll deal with the collateral damage, as it were, as we work our way to this end game.
So I think we could learn here from situations in which in a smaller town, there's a factory that closes. When the plant closes and lays off 500-600 people, all of a sudden there is an existential crisis. And I was not a pastor when a plant closed. I was actually a church choir director in a small town in Illinois when a plant closed. And you know, all of a sudden there are dozens of people in the church who are wondering, not only what do I do now, but who am I now? My life has been defined by working in this plant. So I think there's plenty of, you know, sort of case study to look at and draw from, because it's in many ways the very same thing. When a plant closes and you lose your job, isn't that what's going on internally with you? Isn't that pretty much the same thing as when a robot or a computer takes over the job that you had been doing? And plant closings happen all the time. And so I think if we want to learn, if we do want to get ahead of this, there's plenty of, like I said, case studies that we could use.
And usually the way the government's responded is there's some sort of an agency, of course, that expands its work there, and it's mostly in retraining. First of all, the increase in social services that are provided, tax dollars, usually unemployment benefits go up and so forth. And then it's mostly, can we retrain everybody who are already 40 years old?
And no time is spent on not only – it's all retraining for another job or a different job. Time is spent on, okay, so – what does that mean about who I am?
Sure.
Or my worth as a human being.
No, it's not dealt with at all. No. And one of the things – so I'm curious. I don't know this – I haven't asked you this question before. I usually know the answer to questions at some level before I ask them. But do you ever talk to policymakers in the role that you have? I know that sometimes you end up talking to people that are in positions of, let's call them, minor power. When you talk about things, how engaged are they? Because I know there's some policy issues that you and I have talked about in the past. How engaged are they in actually – trying to address broad implications from just your limited experience in seeing things like that?
A lot of times the policymakers with whom I've spoken are all the time very respectful, obviously pay a lot of attention to what I have to say. And I would say that there are policymakers who kind of are there in terms of what are the big implications, what are the big picture items that we're talking about here. However, I've also encountered policymakers who are very inundated with the minutia and the detail and the inner workings, and get so involved with that small level, and I'll just say small, that minutia of the process, that they don't have time. They simply don't have time to stop, step back, and reflect on what the big implications are of their decisions.
Well, Andy, we've talked about a lot of stuff, and I'm going to let you off the hook and not ask you whether sentient AI in the future can receive the grace of God. That would be for another time.
All right.
Anyway, so thanks so much for stopping by, Andy.
Thanks for the invitation. I really appreciate it.
So once again, this is Dave Cornelison for STEM Spots, signing off.
STEM Spots is available online at ksmu.org.